My favorite sermon of the year. Let us begin by going to the top of the order of service. And you will see a quote there from Clara Barton. And I wonder if we can read it together. Say with me, I have an almost complete disregard of precedent and of faith and the possibility of something better. It irritates me to be told how things have always been done. I defy the tyranny of precedent. I go for anything new that might improve the past. Clara wrote these words when she was founding the Red Cross in the 19th century, and she was inspired by her Universalist faith. She was a lifelong member of the First Universalist Church of Oxford, Massachusetts. Her parents founded that church. Now, unlike Clara, I do not have a complete disregard for precedent, but I do nurture a faith in the possibility of something better. And this faith inspires me this morning in this new year, 2011, as we use this time together to look back at the year gone past, at the top religious news stories. And together this morning, we're here in this room and we're asking these questions. What will become in this new year? Will religion on balance heal more than it hurts? How can we, as Forest Church asks in our reading, begin again? How can we hope? So I believe we can only look forward if we also look back. So here then are my choices for the top 10 religious news stories of 2010. And I want us to notice that in the ceiling, the captain has turned on the seatbelt signs. And in the ceiling, from the ceiling, there drops oxygen masks. Because we can expect turbulence this morning and storminess, but also, I think, a few rays of light. Are we ready? I think somebody said no. Number 10, atheists and agnostics prove they are smarter about religion than everyone else. In a study that had my more orthodox colleagues emit groans of embarrassment, researchers from the Pew Forum of Religion and Public Life phoned thousands of Americans and asked them 32 questions about the Bible and world religion and famous religious figures and constitutional principles involving religion and public life. And among the findings were these: 53% of Protestants, and that includes us, could not identify Martin Luther as the man who started the Protestant Reformation. 45% of Catholics did not know their church teaches that the consecrated bread and wine in Holy Communion are not merely symbols, but actually become the body and blood of Christ. Fewer than one in four, knew that a public school teacher is permitted to read the Bible in class as an example of literature. And only a third knew that a public school teacher is permitted to offer a class comparing the world's religions. On average, people who took the survey answered half the questions incorrectly, and many even flubbed questions about their own faith. Those who scored highest, of course, were the atheists and the agnostics, leading us to wonder, does this mean the more you know about religion, the less you're inclined to believe it? Yeah. Maybe. Or it means that those who do not believe take the time to learn what it is they are rejecting. Or, most likely, I think, it means that people simply do not take the time to think critically about religion because they hear that critical thinking is valued less than blind faith. Or maybe it means that folks just do not care. I mean, ask a kid who Martin Luther is, and they might say back to you, "Is he on Facebook?" No? Don't know him. Here is the good news and bad news about our faith in this room. That here, you are expected to use your mind as well as your heart, your head as well as your spirit. That here I have a free pulpit to express myself as your minister, and all of you have a free pew in which you can disagree with me. That here people are free and expected to judge whether or not to accept the pronouncements of the church. And that here religious assertions must pass through what Emerson called the fire of thought if they are to be accepted as valid. So in other words, let us hit the books and let us keep studying. Number 9, growing persecution of Christians. Now, living as we do in the United States, one of the most religious countries in the developed world, and one where the Christian perspective, especially the Christian conservative perspective, is so loud, we hear that Christians are persecuted. You hear me say that, and you might be saying to yourself, really? Isn't that like saying the bully is getting bullied? So you may be surprised, as I was, I really was, to hear that in the Middle East, which is the home of this faith, half of Iraq's 750,000 Christians have fled the country since 2003. And that in Palestine, Christians are shrinking in number. And that Christians in Nigeria and Pakistan and Egypt have faced this year growing attacks on Christmas Day. A bomb was set off during Mass in the Philippines, injuring 10, including the priest, as he gave his sermon. And on New Year's Day, 21 people were killed worshiping in a church in Egypt. Meanwhile, the Pope used his sermon to decry the loss of religious freedom that has Christians practicing their faith in secret or fleeing their home, often because of radical Islamists who see diversity as a threat. Why does this matter to you and to me? We can drive 1 mile and see a steeple everywhere we go. We who are given the right to worship or not worship as we please. One reason to quote MLK, because a threat to justice somewhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Another reason for us to worry: the Christians in these places are our brothers and sisters because our Unitarian Universalist religion has Christian roots. This is about family. And another reason, because it assaults our nation's and our own religion's core hope, e pluribus unum, out of many one. It's on your money. It means religious freedom and diversity elevate us, and they don't destroy us. So to our Christian friends who are hiding and crouching and running and fearing, we say we are with you in 2011. Number 8, Jesus, Muhammad, and Moses stand before Judge Judy. Or to put it more plainly, the role of religion in the courts. This year, the U.S. Supreme Court convened for the first time ever without a Protestant in its number. There are now 6 Catholics and three Jews. And when they sat down, one of the first cases they heard was the case against the Kansas Westboro Baptist Church that loudly protested funerals of servicemen and women because they believe God is punishing America for its relative tolerance of homosexuality. After closing arguments, I don't know if you heard what God said. God said, "Keep me out of this, and I need a drink." In other cases, the 10th Court of Appeals banned metal crosses at the gravesites of deceased Utah police. The 7th ruled it is okay to have a moment of silence in schools. And the 9th reversed its 2002 ruling on Under God and the Pledge of Allegiance, saying the phrase is not prayer, but rather a recognition of our founders' political philosophy that a power greater than us gives people our unalienable rights. A point taken, I'm thinking, but why was that phrase only added in 1954? Still, whatever the decisions, and whether or not we agree with them, we should be thankful for this, that while in other places in the world, freedom from and for religion is being fought with bombs, in this country, freedom from and for religion is being fought mainly with closing arguments and legal briefs. So we say thank you to Jefferson, a Unitarian. We say thank you to Franklin. We say thank you to Adams, a Unitarian. And we say thank you to Lincoln. How we doing? Number 7, the prolonged recession, the Great Recession, spells trouble for faith communities, putting them in a double bind because contributions decline and the need for faith communities goes up. And there are budget cuts and there are layoffs. In the most high-profile instance of this, Crystal Cathedral. How many of us have heard of that place before? Many of you. It's the megachurch birthplace of the televangelist show Hour of Power. They filed for bankruptcy in October. The 10,000-member church is avoiding credit entirely and spends only the $2 million it receives each month in donations. I'm thinking, $2 million? In our neck of the woods, our own Unitarian Universalist Association, which is headquartered in Boston, has seen its income from congregations and investments decline, resulting in a number of layoffs of my friends and an inability to respond to congregations' needs as we try to fulfill our mission. Emails to some departments, they disappear into a black hole. The long hoped for goal to revitalize and to deepen our denomination's religious education curriculum is on hold. Our ability to do disorganized religion is even better, and that is not a compliment. And more to the point, our congregations in very hard hit areas like the middle part and the western part of this state and Rhode Island and in the whole Midwestern belt, the Rust Belt, these places are in real trouble. And that means they cannot respond to the human need in their communities. Imagine you are on the board of directors, okay, of your church, and you have one question, how to afford this month, and you have three possibilities. Do you turn on the heat in the sanctuary? Do you pay your minister? Or do you buy food for the soup kitchen you run in your basement? What do you do? Meanwhile, I have to say this, that here in this church, we have so much to be thankful for, you and I, that not only we can pay our bills, we can pay our staff, we can fulfill our mission, but also that we have the possibility to dream. We get to build. We have new energy, we have hope. We have strength. So let us say together two things this year. Thank you to the person next to you in the pew, because all of your contributions make all of this possible. All of it. Say thank you. And number two, that with great bounty, and friends, we have such great bounty in this room, there comes great responsibility to open our doors, to give out what we have, to serve, to share, to welcome, to love, because inspiring as our new building is, and it is, I walked through that the other day, it is amazing. We are not about the building. We are instead a people held together by a promise to make love the spirit of this church and service as its law. And the most important part of this promise is not that it is meant just for us. It is meant to be shared. Number six, the turbulence has eased and we are flying smoothly for a minute. You know, you look out a plane window and you see the clouds break and you see rays of light. I see healthcare. I see how faith-based organizations of all kinds were deeply involved in the passage of healthcare legislation this year. Not all in this room will agree with me. Remember, you have a free pew. But I consider it telling testimony that in the midst of all the typical religious strife, the infighting and the outfighting, the slow but precipitous movement of the church from the town green to the back alley in terms of our influence, the one place where we worked together this year, that Methodists and Episcopalians and Congregationalists and some Catholics and Jews, Reformed and Orthodox, and the Unitarian and Universalists and the Evangelicals, all of them, and the Muslims, all of them, do you know what they did? They went to the steps and they said, healthcare is a basic human right. It's a basic human right. Debates about abortion, however, split some groups, most notably the Catholic bishops and the Catholic Health Association, most notably led by Network, an umbrella group of 59,000 nuns. You don't want to make them angry. Who wrote a pointed letter to the bishops calling the bill life-affirming, however imperfect. The bishops were angry, but I said to myself when I read their letter, you go, nuns, you go. Meanwhile, the small Mennonite Church USA inspired me with its own novel healthcare project, the so-called Corinthian Plan, which has 450 of the largest congregations lending assistance to the smaller ones who cannot afford to pay health insurance for its clergy. 70% of the pastors and their families who were not covered before are covered this morning. The plan's name refers to the lines in 2 Corinthians in which Paul urges the abundance of some should be used to meet the needs of others. Which just about answers the question, why healthcare for all in a line, I think. Number five. Issues around gays and lesbians continue to roil churches. Every year, for the last 8 years that I have given this sermon, this issue has been in my top 10. How I pray for a year when I get to report to you, issues around gays and lesbians do not roil churches. But good news, the Episcopal Church USA elects its first lesbian bishop in Los Angeles, sparking the usual controversy. A federal judge overturned Prop 8 that banned same-sex marriage in California. Don't ask, don't tell is repealed in the military, and the people who are most upset about it are not the soldiers, but the chaplains. What does that tell you? But in the midst of all of this good news and real achievement, bullying of several gay students leads to suicide. And while religious groups strongly condemn the bullying, some see it as having religious roots. Several voices, religious voices, including my colleagues, take part in the It Gets Better YouTube video project that encourages gay and transgendered youth not to commit suicide or succumb to depression. And because much of the anti-gay religious rhetoric is inspired by what folks claim to read in the Bible, I will repeat here my two favorite sayings about the Bible and homosexuality. Number one, love trumps Leviticus. Leviticus is the chapter in the Bible that prescribes against homosexuality, but also things like eating shellfish and not covering your hair. And number two, that when reading the Bible, we ought to remember that it is and has through it a love ethic and never so much a sexual ethic. Jesus never said a word, not a single word, about homosexuality, but he did talk a lot about how to love the people next to you. Number four, Ode to Sarah and Glenn. Or in other words, the rise of the Tea Party. In the fall, Mormon and Fox News evangelist Glenn Beck holds a tent revival-like rally on the steps of Washington called Restoring Honor, in which he asks clergy to belong to a new regiment called a Black Robe Regiment, like this one, to help realize that folks realize that God is the answer. Now, I must have been on sabbatical because Glenn didn't call me. Meanwhile, Sarah Palin devotes significant portions of her second best-selling book arguing that candidates for office should take a public Christian stand. Other Tea Partiers stress economic issues more than social or religious ones, leading to a mixed result in the polls. One Tea Party candidate, remember this? Lost in Delaware, Christine O'Donnell, and she was criticized for an ad that stated, what? I am not a witch, after news that she had dabbled in witchcraft earlier in life was leaked to the press. Christine, I wanted to say, Christine, just be who you are. Bottom line, here's what bothers me about Glenn and Sarah and the rest, how their calls back to religion, how God is the answer, always seem to line up so perfectly and so neatly with calls for American nationalism. I mean, are they saying that Jesus was a patriot? Are they saying that he was wrapped up in the manger in a flag? Don't they read the same Bible I do? Jesus made the officials in power nervous and scared. So to Sarah and to Glenn, I say this. I say drink a little less tea and read more closely your Bible. And after yesterday, I say also, don't be so reckless with your rhetoric in 2011. Number three, earth shakes in Haiti, oil spills in the Gulf. In Haiti, where upwards of 230,000 died in the January earthquake, questions of why are religious questions? Said Episcopal Bishop Catherine Shorey, the reality, she said, is that life is not safe or predictable. But she said, what we do with our time in this world, that gives us meaning, you and me. The most important thing she said in a ruined church down there, she said, God does not cause pain or punish people with pain. but God is present in the midst of suffering. She says, above all, you and I can become more human with our broken hearts. Broken hearts, the world over, send money and resources and people, and it is never enough. 6 months later, a BP oil well explodes in the Gulf, spilling millions of gallons of oil into the ocean. In the sea of muck, you might not have heard this story, along the Louisiana coast, Pastor Gerard Stapleton and his staff at St. Patrick's, they are distributing food and $100 gift cards to 300 families in his congregation. Why? Because each of them, all of them, are fishermen and fisherwomen. In his sermon the next Sunday after the spill, he says to his people, God for me is a God of hope, and I don't know how we will work this out, he said, but we will. I want his faith. A month later, Freddie Redmond, who was a homeless guy in the streets of Atlanta, is on the beaches of Mississippi, and he's using his newly acquired skills to clean the beach. He is joined by 75 other low-income people who were trained by a United Methodist program that taught them hazardous waste removal and then took them by bus to the Gulf area. I have gained a career, says Freddie. It has really opened my eyes to a world I did not know. You see the rays of light? I do. Number two, faith-based groups, that's us, lead struggle for immigration reform. And from the efforts to pass comprehensive reform to the work around the DREAM Act in Congress, which ultimately failed because we had to succeed with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, churches and faith-based organizations were always in the forefront. Churches in Arizona, many of ours, responded to the passage of a harsh anti-immigration law by pledging they would not compromise their ministries, even if it meant they would get arrested, and they did. Our own denomination voted to hold its conference in Phoenix in 2012, foregoing much of its business that year to stand witness against the law. These are all the headlines, these are the politics, but what you may not have heard about was what happened on the sidelines. On the sidelines is a guy named Rick Blackston, who this Tuesday, as well as all the other Tuesdays of the past year, he sits down in a church basement with immigrants. He's in Arlington, Virginia, and he teaches them basic computer skills. He teaches them how to type. And he is part of a team from his church, the Unitarian Universalist Church of Arlington, that works with a center serving immigrants mainly from Guatemala and El Salvador. Many states away, in the borderlands between Mexico and Arizona, Forrest Swall from Kansas stuffs food into a bag and water and sweaters that say New England Patriots on them. He's making emergency packs that he will then, with his group, No More Deaths, inspired by our own Tulsa congregation, will place along the trails and the mountains of Phoenix and Arizona and Mexico, placing them there in case anyone who needs them, who is crossing the border, will find supplies to help them live. Why do they do this, these people on the sidelines that don't get reported? Why does it matter to you and to me? Because it is one thing to talk about issues like this in the abstract, and it's quite another to hear someone else's story of children traveling thousands of miles to see their mom again, or undocumented workers who work in the restaurants you and I eat at and pick up the food we shop for and clean the buildings that we live in, being required to work for little pay. Maybe like you, but I cannot get my arms around this issue. But I know what I can do. I can listen to a story. So a challenge that I extend to you in 2011, forget politics and engage with just one immigrant story this year. All right, number one. Let's do it like Jeopardy does it. Who is Jake Isom? Answer, star of my top religious news story of 2010. And let us set the scene. It occurs in Amarillo, Texas in September. It must be very hot. And this is, you remember, at the point of the unprecedented level of Islamophobia and protests against the community center in New York City. Remember that? And the so-called pastor, Terry Jones, remember him? Threatening to burn the Quran. All of this is reaching a boiling point. Jake, he's cruising around on his skateboard. He's in the city center. And he comes up in the city center to this other guy, David Grisham, who's head of a local Christian group called Repent Amarillo. And this guy is near a barbecue grill that he has set up in the city center. And he has in that grill a kerosene-soaked Quran. The local UU Fellowship, the Fellowship of Amarillo, is there protesting this guy, of course. But Jake is more active. He, David Grisham, said something about burning a Quran, recounts Jake in a YouTube video that has since received 300,000 hits, maybe 300,200 after this morning. And so I swooped up behind him on my skateboard and I took his Quran. He said something again about burning it, and I was like, dude, you have no Quran. And then I skated off. I think that's the first time I've said dude in the pulpit. Since then, Isom, who said he does not have any stated beliefs, has been immortalized on The Daily Show. He has a tribute page on Facebook, and he has his own t-shirt. If you Google, dude, you have no Quran, it will turn up dozens of hits, I'm not kidding. Said one Muslim magazine editorial, what's great is that this is coming from Joe America. I mean, Jake Isom has a mullet, he does. And what he did, and the way he responded, said this editorial, gives me more faith in America than anything, any politician or celebrity or minister preaching a sermon can ever do. So friends, enough said. This story is a reminder to me that in the midst of all of the news and the headlines that you and I are confronted with day after day on our phones, on our doorsteps, in our papers, that the most important religious work, it's on the ground, and it's beneath the radar, in acts that seem not religious at all, really. They're the ones happening in church basements where somebody's helping a person from El Salvador learn Microsoft. There's a once homeless guy cleaning a beach in Mississippi who never had a job. There are letters to legislators urging healthcare reform that never get answered. They are sending money and food and whatever you can and prayers to Haiti. They are saving Qurans from burning by skateboard. In other words, the stories beneath the radar are the stories that you have in you when your heart breaks for the world you see and your heart hopes for the world you wish you saw. That's what we hope to create here in this room. So here is to a 2011 that is low on cynicism, high on perspective, generous with hope, compassionate to a fault, quick with laughter, slow to anger, rich with second and third and fourth and fifth and sixth chances, wealthy with forgiveness, blessed with acceptance for what we cannot change, soaked in courage for what we can, and finally, and most importantly, grounded deeply in love. Love that goes deep. Happy New Year, and say with me, Amen.